was once entrusted to the saints, for certain men whose condemnation was written about long ago have secretly slipped in among you. They are godless men who change the grace of our God into a license for immorality and deny Jesus Christ, our only sovereign and Lord. I'm really intrigued by this. Ever so often you see a passage you've seen a million times and something new dawns on you. But his start here, that he really would much rather be talking to them about the salvation that Jesus has offered, the glory of the Christian faith. But instead, he knows it's important to write and urge them to contend, to fight for the faith that was once for all entrusted to the saints. It's a theme throughout the New Testament and the epistolatory material, this deposit of teaching and doctrine that's been handed down to the next generation. And we're to find faithful men to hand it down to the next generation. The emphasis on this body being preserved because it's starting to be corrupted by people coming in either from the outside in some cases, or in this case, he's talking about somebody who slipped in among them with a false set of teachings. And again, the reason for it is given that they're godless who changed the grace of God into license for immorality. They want to do what they want to do, and therefore they don't like the Christian faith as it is. So we've got to find a way to get rid of those restrictions of the Christian faith. And that they deny Jesus Christ, only sovereign and Lord. They aren't worshiping Jesus for who he is. They aren't obeying him for who he is. They are replacing him with a different Jesus, a plastic Jesus that they can mold and twist and turn in different ways to make him what they want of him. And in fact, that is a good summary statement of the new Gnosticism. I talked to last time about the neo-atheist. I actually think the new Gnosticism is a more dangerous, at least in the long range, more dangerous than the new atheism. Because belief in God is high in Western culture. And there are opinion polls that range anywhere from 80 to 93% of Americans believe in the existence of God. So the new atheists have to overcome that barrier, that sort of natural and hereditary sense of the existence of God. Whereas the new Gnostics are modeling a different view of Christianity. And they're doing it in a way that depends, again, on the ignorance of people about how the Bible came to be, how the Christian faith was transmitted. And they're replacing the story of the early Christian church with a whole new mythology of how Christianity came to exist and how the Bible came to be. And people in our culture who no longer know where the Bible came from, even Christians who no longer know where the Bible came from, are buying into this. And I think it has some very damaging effects in many ways. And it's the issue of who gets to define who Christ is, who gets to define what Christianity is. In the early church, the importance of much of the message centered around who Jesus was. Even after the New Testament period, the discussions in the church councils and the creeds was to define who Jesus is, his relationship to God the Father. What is the Godhead and who is Jesus Christ? Look at all the passages in the Gospels. Things like, who is this that even the winds and waves obey him? Is this not Joseph's son? Where did this man get all this? Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? Are you the king of the Jews? Are you the one who is coming, or should we expect another? And Jesus himself, who do men say that I am? Recurring theme everywhere. How are you going to define me? Who are you? And that, again, is the central doctrine of the Christian faith and about which the creeds center. It doesn't argue how do you interpret turn the other cheek. There's no creeds talking about how to define that. But creeds do talk about who is this person and what was his purpose in coming. The apologists of the second century dealt with being able to define Christ and what is this Christian faith or this Christianity that comes from Christ. And the main theme of the Apologist was to deal with all the false ideas that had been circulating, all the rumors about Christians, you know, that they were cannibals, that they practiced incest in their services, you know, all these nasty things that were being said. Because it was a battle for understanding who is the person or who is the group that gets to define this. Did the Christians get to define themselves as the way it was laid down to them by the apostles? Or does somebody external and new to the situation get to define them? And as I say, the new Gnostics are trying to substitute their own meta-narrative of the foundation of Christianity. And it goes something like this. From the very earliest, there were different people who interpreted Jesus in many different ways. And some of them were Orthodox Christians, some of them were Gnostic Christians, some of them were Ebionites, but they all sort of came out of the same source at around the same time. And gradually over a period of time, the group that we now know as Orthodoxy managed to win out. And they got bigger and stronger, and they suppressed everyone else. And finally, at the time of Constantine, they were able to crush their opponents and obliterate their material and pretend that they were the only voice of Christianity. So this idea of history being written by the winners. And that's the gospel of the new Gnosticism. And it appears everywhere from scholarly works, the whole series of new scholars who are drawing their model of what Christianity should be from Gnostic Christianity, down to the popular level treatment of things such as the Da Vinci Code and the sensationalization around the publishing of the Gospel of Judas and those sorts of things. And in people's minds, because of this popular appeal, this is a more accurate story of what went on. And Christians, of course, know that it isn't true, but they don't know how to defend it because they're not really paying too much attention to what this group is saying, at least as a church in large. It's actually a new form of liberalism as well, and you can see the difference, I think, by comparing the two. And old-line liberalism was, at its basis, anti-supernatural. There was no miracles. There was no divine existence out there somewhere. It was simply the world and a vague sense of spirituality that somehow gave your life meaning. The problem with liberalism was it had a time difficulty in trying to portray its view of what Christianity was. And that was the documents we have in the first century are so close to the events that took place by people who had connection with eyewitness testimony that it became difficult to substitute the liberal view with the Orthodox view with this new liberal view. They simply had to explain how you could get that much accrual of legend around the initial occurrence in that short a period of time. So it was always a constant problem for liberalism. And liberalism's solution always was to try and argue that the books of the New Testament were written much later than they appeared to be, and therefore had no connection with eyewitnesses, no connection geographically with the events at hand. And unfortunately, constantly, they were being pushed back. You know, there was a time when the argument was that the book of Acts wasn't written until around 200 AD. Unfortunately, we have a fragment of Acts from the first third of the second century, so obviously that can't be. So they've been forced over a period of time to come back and say, okay, we have to concede that these were written within at least the possibility of a lifetime of eyewitnesses. Also, old-line liberalism had what's called the hermeneutic of suspicion. The idea is that you have to doubt everything. That's your starting point. Until a statement can offer justification for its being there by evidence or argumentation, you had to assume that it wasn't a true statement. So you approach it thinking this stuff isn't true, unless you're forced to admit some element of it is true. Now, the advantage to old-line liberalism was, for the most part, evangelicals and conservatives didn't have to pay too much attention to them. The scholars in liberalism taught at liberal schools, and they talked to themselves, but nobody else heard it. the churches were all shrinking, the liberal churches. You know, they were dying 1,001 deaths every time you turned around. New ones were either closing down, or old ones were either closing down, or new ones were being formed by three or four shrinking liberal congregations, and they had to sort of prop each other up. And so it was problematic to get a sort of triumphal message out of that when you're not even reaching your own people. Because the problem, of course, with liberalism is they so imitated the society around them that they had nothing to offer. Unfortunately, that's not true with the new Gnosticism. And again, part of the secret is this: people have become media savvy, including our enemies. And so just as the new atheism is using popular media to reach audiences that weren't reached before, so the new Gnosticism is doing that as well. So you have a whole spate of specials on the History Channel and National Geographic and all these people doing sensational versions because, let's face it, the heresy of the day is more interesting than the old story. You know, if you can say something that'll shock people and continue to do that, and that's part of the problem with this approach, is that once you start down that line, you've got to have a new heresy each time. Because even the old heresy, or the one that you introduced last week, is now old. It's been a week in the media. Now we've got to come up with something to attract their attention again. But they've been able to milk that and use that to their advantage. And then people like Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons and all those can get away with what they say because they claim it's fiction. But at the same time, many, many people who believe it also think that there's a validity and reality behind them that's true. The new Gnosticism is not particularly anti-supernatural. They just the question really is of uninterest to them. Spirituality is primarily an internal thing, so they don't deny that there's supernatural reality. They just generally deny that the supernatural reality that the Bible talks about isn't real. And by reframing the discussion, they no longer have the old time difficulty that the liberalism, old line liberalism, had. Because what they're saying is, yeah, there was this Christian tradition from the very earliest, but there were also other voices that we haven't heard for many years, and they had a perfectly valid take on things as well. And they were suppressed. And, of course, you know, if something's been suppressed, the suppressor is the fault there. And so you're more eager to listen to the new voice because it's something that is free and expresses liberty rather than some group suppressing it. They also start with a hermeneutic of suspicion, but it doesn't come out as blatant. Because you are, instead of starting talking about alternative voices, you know, and we in America, the melting pot of the world, love to elevate alternative voices and listen to all sorts of different things. Unfortunately, to tolerate other things is not the same thing as to endorse them, and we haven't learned that lesson yet. Read you a little bit of some of the. A quote of some of the people writing about this. Elaine Pagels, who's written several bestsellers, but was best known for the Gnostic Gospels that she wrote probably a couple decades ago now, who was one of the first to argue in a scholarly way for this. And she was, again, smart enough to put her material in a popular level book so it would have some impact on the culture rather than just, you know, a handful of scholars in an ivory tower somewhere. Here's what she says in sort of summarizing this discovery of Gnostic Gospels in Nag Hammadi. You may have heard of this. We've talked about it certainly here before. But they discovered a cache of Gnostic literature at Nag Hammadi in the late 40s, actually almost in the time range of the Dead Sea Scrolls within a short period of time. And here's her description of that. What they found in that discovery was over 50 early Christian texts. Notice she's defining these heretical texts already as Christian texts. Discovery was that over 50 early Christian texts that we had just never known about. We knew there were terrible heretics that said terrible things, but we didn't have what they actually said. We only had what their enemies said. It's like reading what one political party says about the other, trying to reconstruct their opponent's viewpoints. it really doesn't work well at all. So for the first time, we had a very wide range of early Christian sources, and we begin to see very clearly that what we call Christianity is a rather small selection or small slice of a much wider horizon. What survived as Orthodox Christianity did so by suppressing and forcibly eliminating a lot of other material. In other words, these nasty Christians were able to suppress all these wonderful free-thinking people who were following Jesus in the right way. She goes on, it's hard to characterize these texts in one simple way because there's a whole library of different things. But most of them are about the premise of finding access to God for oneself. That's what the monks who hid them, that's why the monks who hid them liked them. And that's why the bishops didn't like them. Because if you can't find God, if you can find God for yourself, you might not need a church or a bishop or the whole ecclesiastical apparatus. Now, there's so many things wrong with that statement, you don't even know where to begin. One is, of course, we've known about these documents, even though we didn't have them in our hands until the middle of the 20th century. The early church fathers talked about them in detail. Irenaeus has got multiple volumes on defining and describing and telling about the different sects of Gnosticism at the end of the second century. And almost everything at Nag Hammadi was already known about in an accurate way from that. Now, there is the possibility of one or two sects that he didn't have firsthand material on, and he probably quoted some things that he'd heard about them that maybe weren't true. But 99% of what Irenaeus said was already widely talked about in the early church and known about, and we've known about it since then. This is not new material, but notice the way they frame it. We didn't know about this because it was suppressed and nobody ever heard about this stuff before. And now, for the first time, we can see what these other voices were saying. Yeah, it's absolute nonsense. I have a quote here also from Karen King, who also is one of these individuals. Until recently, the texts that survived have shown only the side that won. The new texts are therefore crucial in constructing a fuller and more accurate portrait. The Gospel of Mary, for example, argued that leadership should be based on spiritual maturity, regardless of whether one is male or female. This gospel lets us hear an alternative voice to the one dominant in canonized works like 1 Timothy, which tried to silence women and insist their salvation lies in bearing children. We can now hear the other side of the controversy over women's leadership and see what the arguments were given in favor of it. Again, the idea that somehow this horribly oppressive group got control of Christianity and got to define who it was. The problem is, of course, because that's the popular story, that's the heresy of the day. It's plastered everywhere, and people who don't know anything about how the Bible did come to be are quite willing to accept that. And it's always convenient and interesting that the issues that they discover in these ancient documents are their own issues. You know, these two feminist scholars up in Baynard discover the Gnostic Gospels are really feminist documents. In order to do that, of course, they have to ignore all those documents of Gnosticism that say in order to get to heaven, you got to become a man. But we don't talk about that part of the Gnostic Gospels, only the parts that seem to indicate what we want. But it's one of those deals where, again, they're looking for a way to escape the definitions that Christianity gives of us as sinful men and women in need of a Savior, and instead want to substitute their own little philosophical or socio-political agenda. And when they go to these documents and look for that, lo and behold, they find it. I wonder if we could accuse them of suppressing those parts about becoming male. Well, again, the planks of the new Gnosticism is that no one knows for sure what happened. You know, it's all murky back then. We don't really know for sure what happened, but they seem to know that what it was wasn't what the New Testament says. A lot of this comes from liberal biblical criticism, redaction criticism, for example, the idea that the Gospels weren't written by the people that whose names are at the start of the Gospels, and they didn't have anything to do with those people. there were simply Christian groups that were isolated from other Christian groups, and so they wrote their own gospel, and they made up their own gospel to address the sociological issues of their day and their location. And that has heavily affected this idea that the Gospels aren't reliable history, because they had nothing to do with either the geographical location, the individuals involved. There were just these isolated groups of Christians all over the empire, and they need something to work with, so they are allowed to make up their own gospel and address whatever issues are important to that community, which is why the difference in their mind between the various Gospels. There's so many things wrong with that, but again, Christians usually haven't heard it, and so the first time they come up against it, they don't know what to do. The fact is, you know, if you look at the early material, this idea of isolated Christian groups at various places in the empire just simply isn't true. I mean, even look at the material in the earliest stages in the Gospels and the New Testament materials themselves. You know, the Roman Empire was a reasonably mobile society. People traveled all over in those days, and we're shocked today because we think of 18th and 19th century America as being people who were stuck in the farm, didn't go anywhere, and so ancient history must have been even worse. But it was a very mobile society. It was worldwide, and Christianity was a worldwide movement. I mean, look at the people we know. The apostles and the people that hung out with the apostles, look at all the different places they went in the empire. The Apostle Paul himself, for example. And where he goes, he often then talks about other churches, what other churches are doing. You know, he tells the Corinthians, there aren't any practices, this isn't practiced in any different way in any of the other churches anywhere across the empire. He wasn't ignorant of these, you know, the groups were in isolation from each other. There were people touring back and forth between churches. And Paul, in his writings, in a number of places, takes account of them. Secondly, the highly mobile church leadership. Paul and his companions, if you look at Timothy and Titus and Tychicus and others, you'll find them popping up at different places, even in the book of Acts. They're not in one place. They're not stationary ministers. They're people that are touring around. So churches provide communication among different groups through their itinerant teachers. And then you look at something like the Jerusalem Council, where when it comes time to decide an issue, they aren't off on their own writing gospels to address these issues. They're bringing them together to sit down and discuss what is it that we're going to do about this practice. Does it fit within the framework anyway of what Jesus said, or is there some way we can understand it within that framework? It wasn't a matter of inventing things. And finally, if you look at the things that the gospels address, why aren't they addressing, if they're just made up to address issues in that particular culture in that time as they came up, why is there no discussion of things like circumcision? And the church was practically split in two over that and had to deal with it in a fashion where they were able to put a universal council together, make a decision, and then take that decision out in a reconciliatory fashion. Jesus never makes a declaration on that. You know, if you look at all the issues that the early church faced that were major issues, there's no invention anywhere in the Gospels that addressed them. Why would those be the issues that you wouldn't have any sayings on if it was made up? I mean, all of these things add up to a very basic refutation of what these people are saying. But again, because many Christians treat the Bible as if it fell from the sky one day, bound in leather and gold-edged, and that's where it came from, and that's all we know about it. I remember a couple of decades ago, I was teaching at a church on how the Bible came to be, and I remember one guy saying, oh, I didn't have any problem believing it was the Word of God when I didn't know it had a history, but now I see the history, I don't know. It should have been the exact opposite. The fact that this is rooted in history, in solid history, gives us great confidence and actually an apologetic advantage over alternative views. But, we have cut it all apart from its historical context. And so we don't know how the Bible came to be. It's just there and we trust it, you know. Jesus loves me, this I know, before the Bible tells me so. And that may be sufficient for you, but again, you're not here just for yourself. You're here to win others, and they may require more than that. Richard Balcom, in talking about this whole process, says this: further details of the few of these named persons will reinforce the point. John Mark, a member of a Cypriot Jewish family settled in Jerusalem, and a member of the early church, he was in Antioch, accompanied by his cousin Barnabas and Paul on their missionary journey as far as Pamphylia, later accompanied Barnabas to Cyprus, and finally heard of in Rome, if Philemon was written from Rome, where 1 Peter also places him. Philip the evangelist, a member of the Jerusalem church, then a traveling missionary in Palestine, settled in Caesarea Maritima with his prophet daughters, and finally, according to reliable 2nd century tradition, in Hierapolis in Asia Minor with two of his daughters, while a third ended her days in Ephesus. Aquila and Priscilla, Jews who lived in Rome, though Aquila was originally from Pontus, until the Jews were expelled from Rome under Claudius, were apparently already Christians when Paul first met them in Corinth. So these aren't stationary people that are unrelated to other church groups. This thing goes all over. Where they moved to Ephesus, where the church met in their house, but later returned to Rome. There's no reason to suppose that such movements were untypical of the Christian leaders of the first generation. And again, you have to rewrite the whole history in order to get there. And you can only rewrite history if people are unaware of the right history. You know, the thing from Orwell, you know, he who controls the past controls the present. And he who controls the present controls the past. I mean, there's a circle here of control. If you can control the story, you can affect people in their understanding and outlook in life. Another plank of the Neo-Gnostics, or the New Gnostics, is that Jesus' message when he was here on earth was primarily political and social. He was looking to set up a new form of governance, a new form of way people interact with each other. He wasn't there to promote any sort of otherworldly salvation. He wasn't there to be sacrificed for our sins. He was there as a social political prophet. A third plank is that Paul was the inventor of Christianity. Jesus was this cynic philosopher running around the countryside, and after he died, a few years later, Paul came along and made it into something totally different. And then the final plank of the new Gnosticism is that of being public relations oriented. And that is such a big deal in our day. If you want your message out, you've got to put it in a slick form that's done according to standard advertising and not in some detailed content oriented material. People won't put up with content. What they will put up with is little slogans and little quotes that capture the essence of what they're trying to say, and they don't have to back it up with anything. Now, I have seen a number of people who have already been affected by this. I talked to somebody I worked with many years ago. I ran into her in a bookstore recently. What are the odds? She was never anything other than an extremely nominal Christian. I think they probably were one of those groups, her and her husband, that went to church on Easter and Christmas, and they were lucky if they showed up then. But she had a son who went into who had became a Christian under InterVarsity, but he decided for some reason he preferred Catholicism, so he became a Catholic, and he entered the priesthood. Well, all this is, of course, a puzzlement to her, why her son wouldn't want to get married and have grandkids, but instead is going to become a Catholic priest. This is really weird. But as a result of his becoming a Catholic, she started going to a Bible study of Catholic women, I can't imagine what this group must look like, but She apparently is the one that gets to go out and do research on various topics and come back in and present it to the group. And she's saying, you know, I'm the lone Protestant representative there. And she goes, oh, I'm not really sure I'm a Protestant anymore. Actually, I'm not really sure I'm a Christian anymore. And I said, really? Why is that? Well, when I discover all these weird things about, you know, what was included and not included in the Bible. And again, the whole thing of coming across these new presentations of how the Bible came to be and that we suppressed certain things arbitrarily and elevated certain other things has become part of her understanding of what Christianity is. And so when you go out and present now a fairly straightforward presentation of the gospel, and their minds are already translating it through that grid. Oh yeah, these are one of those conservative people, the group that, you know, was the victors and suppressed everything else, and you know, they really don't know the true story. I know the true story. And that, unfortunately, is going to be the case. You're going to find that happen in the media. The media has already taken notice of the new Gnostics. When you see those occasional attempts by networks to put on specials at Easter time or Christmas time, you can look for about three-quarters of the outside spokespeople, the experts that they bring in, to be from the neo-Gnostic line. Half of the remaining ones are from old-line liberalism, and then there's that small remaining little segment of when they're generous, they'll have evangelical scholars in, but only because they want to seem inclusive. It's not because they're presenting that as an actual view that needs to be seriously considered, but they want to make sure that they don't turn off any of their constituency. You know, there are Christians that watch this network, so we can't afford to offend them too bad. But for the most part, they can assume that what the Gnostics and liberals say will go over our heads. You know, we don't know enough to counteract it. And that cannot be the case. We've got to, again, be ready to earnestly contend. And again, it's not that this is a difficult challenge. It's difficult only, again, by the fact that normally when our enemies come out with something, they come out with it because they know that Christians don't know the other side. They don't know their own case. And therefore, they can assert certain things as being true, and nobody's going to call them on it. You know, they may disagree, but to argue specifically why it's not correct is difficult. And therefore, they know that they can get away with certain amounts of freedom when it comes to presenting their case that won't be given when Christians are trying to present their case. We can't let them redefine either the origins of our Christianity or the definition of who Jesus was. Jesus was not some sort of fuzzy speaker of New Age thoughts and positive thinking, and we cannot let that become the common understanding, the conventional wisdom about what Christianity is. And we're very much in danger of that. Now, along with this goes another movement, which is people that sort of have emphasis on both these groups I've talked about, the new atheist and the new Gnosticism. And there you have a series of biblical scholars who come from either a liberal tradition or they've been converted to the liberal tradition, who are trying their best to undermine the history behind the Gospels, the Epistles, the New Testament as it's written. And this is, again, an important reason why Christians need to know how the Gospels came to be collected together, how the Epistles came to be collected together, how they're rooted in history, demonstrations of why they're rooted in history, against the other people who would say, well, you don't really know where these came from, and in fact, they're just inventions by people and isolated Christian communities that were elevated by the Emperor Constantine. You know, the stuff they're saying is so patently false on an unbiased historical statement, let alone as a Christian, that it's amazing that they can get by. You know, there are books written on how Constantine made Jesus God. You know, I want to tear my hair out when I hear stuff like this. It's so bizarre. I mean, the whole discussion was not whether Jesus was God or not. It was what type of God is Jesus? Is he God of the first order, like God the Father, or, you know, or is he a lesser God? That was where the discussion was. It wasn't Constantine suddenly saying, I know, we'll make Jesus a God. That was a discussion that wasn't even in the horizon at that point. But again, if you don't know history, and several things contribute to this, our educational system certainly doesn't help us in that manner. We don't generally discuss those content-laden sort of things in church. And in addition, we're Protestants, and so we've sort of written off all the church history that happened between the Apostle Paul and Luther.
And how did Constantine get to be somehow our hero? I mean, that's bizarre if you know anything about Constantine.
Well, not only that, but Constantine, because he has that pre-Christian lifestyle and attitude towards things, becomes a convenient person. You know, it's like trying to associate us with Hitler. I mean, you know, pick out somebody who really was oppressive and bad and identify a community with them, and you immediately got people against them. So what's the solution? The solution is, of course, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that is within you. And that's where we often fall down. Too much evangelicalism has a lot of fun on Sunday mornings, but they don't do much in terms of equipping the saints to help us go out and do battle with the world, to spread the gospel. Instead, we're more interested in our own inner feelings. You know, we like sort of metaphysical navel-gazing as the world around us heads off into eternal damnation. And for the most part, we don't really care. And that's perhaps the bizarre thing. So, again, the solution is to be prepared. I want to read a quote here from the Lutheran Hour's description of Bart Ehrman. And Ehrman's a guy we're going to talk about in detail next week. But he is quoted both by the neo-Gnostics, and he's generally the only authority that the neo-liberals talk about or quote in their works. Hitchens even quotes him. I mean, it doesn't have any biblical scholars in there except a reference to Bart Ehrman. And as I say, Ehrman grew up and went to all the best evangelical schools as well. Bart often says, you know, I've become an atheist because I realized that the Bible's just, you know, couldn't possibly be the Word of God, couldn't be inerrant in any way, can't be authoritative to Christians. But I'm not really trying to hurt anybody's faith. But anyway, here's Luther Hour's take on it. Dr. Bart Ehrman isn't trying to destroy anyone's faith. On the other hand, Dr. Ehrman, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, has concluded 19 of the 27 books in the New Testament are forgeries. The divinity of Jesus isn't based on anything the Savior or his earthly followers said. Jesus didn't rise from the dead, and the disciples had visions of Jesus. No, Bart Ehrman, like many other scholars, isn't trying to destroy people's faith. On the other hand, when he is done sharing his point of view, a great many who listen to him will find their faith is left with, well, nothing. And again, as things shift, you can't assume any sort of presumption of truth here. Everybody's going to view the Orthodox Christian view with a hermeneutic of suspicion. Everything in it's wrong, made up, and we need to get this cleared, and we're going to assume that until you prove to us that it's true. And so the solution for us is to demonstrate the truth of it and to know enough about how the Bible came to be, how these books existed in the first place, and how they came to be collected together, and how they came to be preserved. You know, the average person who's not a Christian thinks that the Bible's full of all sorts of errors, contradictions. And Christians come in and they assume it's perfectly inerrant, so therefore there's no reason to defend it. And the two are shooting by each other without ever talking on the same level and the same topics. Our task is not only our personal salvation, our task is to take the message out as an ambassador of Christ to the rest of the world. And it's too easy for us to shirk that off and not do the homework we need to do that. And so we need to be more diligent and attune ourselves to that task.